We are university sound archivists, but few preside over as large a collection as the nearly 250,000 recordings in the Bowling Green University collection. Since 1967, our next speaker, William Shirk, has been sound recording archivist at Bowling Green University. He is also known to you as Bowling Green hosted a recent meeting. William Shirk will speak on a report on the Bowling Green University's NEH grant for its sound recording archive. Mr. Shirk.
I'm going to do the same trick, except I'm going to get it right up near my mouth. So if I salivate, you'll know. I'm known to salivate. Yes, over records. No. If I see anybody that urges me to salivate, I'll look away. It's really a pleasure for me to be here. I feel nude, even though I'm dressed. I feel nude because normally when I ever make a presentation, I have a tape. I'm always playing some type of music to demonstrate a specific subject. Like if you remember my Nashville talk on party records. All right, I don't have the crepitation contest with me today. And I hope I don't hear one. What I'm here today is to report on the NEH grant, which was awarded the Sound Recordings Archives at Bowling Green State University in 1984. I want to give you just a short background sketch on the collection for those that are not familiar with it. I conceived the collection in 1967 at Bowling Green State University when I was appointed to the faculty there. It was to be conceived as a support collection for the existing academic needs of the university, which included one or two jazz courses, a few classes in folklore, and the English and theater courses in spoken word and poetry and prose. The normal run-of-the-mill bill of fare for most university record collections at that time. I myself, a staunch rock and roller, felt very constrained, but I had to fulfill my duties as a, was appointed to the faculty at that time. But fortunately for me, the popular culture, the world-recognized popular culture program began to become organized about the middle to late 1968, and by 1969 we had developed a full-fledged academic department which was called the Department of Popular Culture, and which offered not only a bachelor's but a master's degree in popular culture. And at that time is when I also conceived the Popular Culture Library, which went hand in hand with the collection building profile for the Sound Recordings Archive, which immediately allowed me to change the profile to include anything under the sun that I felt was related to the popular recorded medium. And then in 1971, in addition to the bachelor's and master's degree offered at the university, we also then established a PhD and began to offer a PhD in American culture. And ever since, I think it was 1969, there has been a national meeting of the Popular Culture Association meeting. We just had our, I think it was 15th or 16th meeting. I just got back from about a week and a half ago where I made a presentation on parody songs from 1940 to the present, from Spike Jones to Weird Al Yankovic. And we had them rolling in the aisles. So that's why I feel nude here, not without any music. The collection which I built related to the needs of the popular culture department and the extended needs of scholars in popular music, which began to rise immediately with the inception of our department. We have included from the beginning of the popular culture movement any type of recording related to any form of popular medium. The reason I don't exclude music, just include music, is that we have not only pop, rock, jazz, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, country and western, soul, reggae, new wave, any type of musical, popular musical form that has struck the fancy of the American record-buying public since, you know, the late 1800s to the present, but also popular spoken word recordings such as a tremendous collection of comedy and sermons, speeches, novelty records, you know, you name the type of medium that we have in the recording collection, and that's part of our over quarter of a million holdings. The collection, which began in 1967, as soon as I began the collection, I saw from the beginning that not only must the Library of Congress rules, of course, be followed in cataloging the materials, but we also must trace every major artist and every song on every album, because we were basically cataloging the albums even though we were building a 45 and 78 collection. And the LPs number over 100,000 as of now, but that we must trace every song title on every album that we cataloged. So that meant that in the beginning, from 1967 to about 1980, as I was cataloging about the 35,000 LPs or so, it was all done semi-mechanically by hand, meaning that the main entry cards were typed, the cards were sent down and duplicated in our duplicating room, and then brought back up the whole set, and then the students would then type the title tracings on the top. Well, the libraries during that period of time entered into cooperation with the OCLC database, and our library, along with over 2,000 other libraries throughout the United States, subscribed to the OCLC database, which is centered in, the main offices are in Dublin, Ohio, which is just north of Columbus. And only in about 1980 or so were we starting to input the phonograph recordings into the database of the OCLC. Well, even then, I was the only one who was cataloging this material, which meant that, as anybody knows, you get one record, you catalog one record, and 5 to 10 come in. So the quicker I was working, the behinder I was getting. So myself and my associate, who was appointed along with, was appointed to become the music librarian, so we have the liaison with the College of Musical Arts and our music recordings collection for the College of Musical Arts. Between the two of us, we devised plans to present a grant to first the Department of Education. They did not allow us any money, so we reapplied to the National Endowment for the Humanities, and it was accepted in June of 1984. We had originally asked for a two-year grant for $200,000 to catalog 30,000 LPs dated from about, we'll say, 1948 to 1980. The wisdom of the National Endowment for the Humanities, much as, you know, we have to thank it, they gave us $100,000 for 1 year for 15,000 records, but they considered that the recordings from 1970 to date at that time were not academically viable. So we left it at that, and we have, as the grant was awarded to us in June of 1984, the grant began in August of 1985. The money was used for hiring two full-time catalogers with MLA degrees. Both of them also have degrees in music. We also have a full-time office, added office manager, and a whole band of student employees who do typing of the various, for various purposes, and filing of cards. And so that between the two full-time catalogers and myself, who originally cataloged recordings maybe about 30% of my time, I now am devoting about 75 to 80% of my time cataloging LPs every day. I mean, it's intense, to say the least. But between the three of us, per week, we are cataloging probably about 400 LPs. About 400 LPs a week are being cataloged and input into the OCLC database. Now, the selling point for acquiring this grant was the fact that we would be inputting catalog records, original catalog records, which was saving the cataloging time and expertise of the other participating libraries in the that participate in the OCLC database. So we were able to actually create the cataloging like Library of Congress does for some of their recordings, but us for the field of popular music. And so we began in earnest in August of 1985. See how the years, the months have flown by quickly when you're having fun. But in the meantime, once we were awarded this first $100,000 grant, we immediately applied for a renewal. And it was awarded. So we have extended our grant, and it was actually just a little bit modified in the fact that we were awarded $75,000 and we have to come up with another $25,000 matching. But you know, there's not too much problem with that. So that, in fact, we have not yet even finished our first year, and fortunately we are now going to have the second year to work with. But we still have to work with the LPs that are cataloged from about 1948 to 1970. And if any of you aren't familiar with the OCLC database, in inputting original records, we follow the MARC format for inputting all of our materials at what is called the eye level. There are two levels of inputting. Eye level is basically for those who strictly follow the inputting format. The K level follows the format, but it's basically used by school libraries and smaller public libraries. And we basically discount that format. But about 99% of the libraries that input records, not recordings, you have to know, change the nomenclature, records into the OCLC database, according to the cataloging rules, you must include the contents of the record album, but you do not have to trace the song titles. And about 99% of the libraries that input into the OCLC database do not trace any of the song titles. We, of course, do trace all of the song titles that are allowed within the parameters of the format. And of course, I'll go into a couple of the problems. But we, of course, in extending this cataloging venture, we are, of course, expanding the entire capabilities of the OCLC database so that any library or any user who comes into a library that has the OCLC terminals may sit down at the terminals and call up a specific artist or a specific song title, or matching an artist with a song title, and come up with records that will appear on the terminal indicating that it exists in such and such a library. And of course, you can, by calling up a certain coding, find out the holdings of that particular record. And the idea, of course, is that we are one of those libraries which hold this material. And what we have discovered, of course, is immediately we are also running a double check on libraries that are using our cataloging. So we also run a double check, because not only that we are putting it in, but that actually it is being used by other libraries. And we run checks on this and also through our interlibrary loan so that we know how many people actually make contact with our collection. The collection itself is open to the public to use. See, this is all bears upon the fact that, you know, ours, like many other archives, it's not a circulating library, and it's used basically by our students and our faculty, but also any visiting scholar may come to the collection and use the collection by listening to it. And we have a series of audition rooms, and we usually work on a one-to-one basis through letters of introduction, so that any scholar in any library that uses the OCLC terminal and discovers that we have a series of recordings that they need for research can come under special introduction, can come to use our collection. Up to now, there have been very few title indexes, and this is my main point even in the beginning, to an entire large body of LP recordings. So in addition to the 35,000, which we already have just in our card catalog, which sometime we're going to be converting to the OCLC database, that we are in addition are adding another 15,000 this first year and then 12,000. But we have to leave time for vacations, because the staff, when they come on the first year, they have to work 12 months straight working for the state. And then they accrue time for vacations. So we have to take into consideration their vacations this second year. But through the next 2 years, that means that there will be an additional 27,000 records added to the OCLC database, each with an average of 12 songs per album. So you can imagine the amount of titles that have been added to the database. And we are, in addition, adding other new albums at the same time. but there are not that many indexes to that great amount of albums as of now. I mean, we're familiar with Phonolog and a number of other books that are available that do some indexing of album titles. But this, we hope, you know, will turn into, you know, one of the better indexes of song titles available to researchers in the United States. Did you have a question?
Yeah, is there any plans to put it out as a comp catalog on Fee-Schlader?
Probably. We'll have to wait and see, because it will not end with the grant. See, we are starting with the grant, but even at the speed, they're still bemoaning the fact that I'm still buying records faster, no matter what. There's no stopping Shirk. You know, there's no stopping me, because I know. Pardon me?
You flatten your tires on Saturday.
Yeah,
morning.
Yeah. No, I've got two cars. They got to catch the right car. They got to catch the right car. But somewhere along the line, I'm sure that we're going to be dealing with that situation.
Because, as you know, a lot of the OCLC records are bad. You can segregate your own.
I know many of them are bad. There's a lot of problems in addition to, because when we can also search by manufacturer's number. So we run a batch search. We can run a batch search and can identify complete labels all at once. Of course, when you call up LPM 1001, you're going to get RCA Victor, but can you imagine how many other record companies have assigned LPM 101 to their records? And so, yes, Jerry?
A possible explanation of why the National Endowment for the Humanities did not fund cataloging for materials after 72, I think, was the date.
Ours, it was 70. They said nothing after 1970.
Well, a possible explanation is 72. They may have the wrong date.
Mm-hmm.
Is that anything received for copyright deposit in the Copyright Office of the Library of Congress, which is February 15, 1972,
mm-hmm.
has full title, performer, label name, issue number, claimant, registration, and index form
mm-hmm.
since 1978 with its own line, or in-house use of the library, and you may buy a hard copy of that.
Mm-hmm.
It is not only popular music, it is classical music, it is non-music,
right.
It is any sound recording.
Right.
So that may be a...
That's possible, but I remember in the report there was some statement to the effect, you know, that they considered the 1950s and 1970s more viable at that time. Somebody made that statement. So, I mean, but... at the same time, as we go through our records, because as you remember with the Rodgers and Hammerstein archives, you went through them and you kicked and bumped boxes and what have you. Ours is similar to that, and our uncataloged records are arranged the same way. And when we began cataloging the major labels first, and of course, me being the senior cataloger got to pick my favorite labels so that, you know, I'm cataloging Star Day and King and Parkway and Cameo, you know, some of my favorite titles. And my associate, who basically was not involved with much of the cataloging, said she would do some of the labels. She said, well, I'm going to try a little bit of Imperial. After she got through Ricky Nelson and Slim Whitman, she said, oh, I don't want that anymore. You take them all. So, you know, I had to finish them all, and Fats Domino too. I think I had done most of the Fats Domino by that time. Johnny Rivers, I did, but so basically, I'm picking my own labels because I enjoy those. Because remember, when I catalog, I've got to do something while I catalog. So I listen to the records. So I'm sitting in the audition room, and I'm cataloging, you know, and I just, you know, you have to preview the records anyway. But what is nice is that we're going to these major labels and pulling them off the shelf, giving us more room to put more albums back on. And we always, of course, have a huge backlog of albums that have to be shelved on there at the same time. Yes, there's a, yes?
Yeah, on those 400 records per week that you catalog, the LP, could you give us an idea how much is copy cataloging and how much is original, and roughly how much labor it takes to do original cataloging of one LP?
Okay, good question. Maybe I didn't make myself clear that the reason behind our getting this grant is that we were to do only original cataloging. We were only doing, everything that we do is all original cataloging, no copy cataloging whatsoever. If we find it in the OCLC database, we run a print of the record, we slip it in, and we put it back on the shelf. so that in fact we are only adding new records and everything is original cataloging. I mean, if you ever seen some of the quality of the cataloging on the OCLC database, sometimes that takes longer in editing than trying to do your own original cataloging. But as I said, if we've got two people working 8 hours a day, and I'm working, say, about 6 hours a day, that's 22, 8, 16. Gotta calculator, 8 and 8 are 16, and 6, about 22 hours a week. So there you can figure your arithmetic. But, pardon me? I'm in a day, yeah. There you go. So 22 hours of cataloging a day times 5 over, you know, and then you divide in the number of records that we're cataloging. There's about the number of records that the speed at which we catalog. And, pardon me? Good. Good question. There we get to that. So this all leads into one bit after another. The authority file, of course, we have established our own authority file based first on the file that has been established in the OCLC database. There is an authority file for names in the OCLC database, and we use that as the first authority. Then we go to the Music Books and Records, the MBMSR, a publication put out by the Library of Congress, which lists all music books and recordings that have been cataloged. And if you've been in libraries, it's the big red set of books. And there are name authorities in there which are not yet even on the authority file. That is our second jump. And then the third is going to the various book and other sources that we know of, that we have in our collection, that also will give us name authorities, and then the record in hand. The problem we come across is when you start working with country and Western artists and a lot of the black artists of the 1940s, 1950s, and 60s, you come across people with the same names. You have a lot of problems in trying to establish, and we hate to use descriptors like musician or banjo player if you don't have a date. It's very disconcerting to use this. So we do all we can to find a birth date for every artist that needs it to distinguish that person from another one, like the country singer Bobby Lewis. There was a country singer named Bobby Lewis whose main instrument was a lute, but he also played guitar. And then you have the rhythm and blues singer Bobby Lewis, who his big hit was Tossin' and Turnin' for Belltone Records. You have Bobby Lewis, the rhythm and blues singer, had a date we found in the Norm Knight Rock On reference book. But Bobby Lewis, the country singer, we didn't have, and no reference book gave it. Sometimes I've been able to get help from other libraries. Country Music Foundation has been very helpful. Rodgers and Hammerstein, I call them up once in a while to get information. But also the musicians' unions. I've established rapport with a number of different musicians' unions, like especially in Nashville, and I'll call them up, and I did that for Bobby Lewis. And he was a session musician in Nashville, and I was able to get the birth date for him.
Bill?
Yes?
How about the use of matrix numbers in order to find dates?
Okay, well, we're dealing with LPs.
Oh, LPs.
So it doesn't matter. I mean, it does, not that it doesn't matter, but it's matrix numbers aren't, you know, that helpful. And dates, we are trying to pinpoint the date of issue of all the LPs that we catalog as closely as possible, not as many times 19-, or 196-? We're trying to clean that up and trying to get a year, a specific year. Yes, Mike?
How do you handle renumberings?
Okay, well, all of this, I mean, a good example is right...
You have to do a whole new file for renumber.
Okay, well, there is one field in the OCLC database, it's the 028 field for the manufacturer's name, number, and name. Okay, and good example is now I'm doing Starday Records, and if any of you know the history of Starday Records, when they were bought out by Gusto, the numbering system, not that it was run all askew, but many times the label would say Gusto, the cover would say Starday. Well, what we try to do is you must list in the 028 field, that's going to be the official field for the record company, the one that you do find on the label, like SLP 452 Gusto. On the cover, it says SLP 452 Starday. So what we do is we make a note saying what we have found as an alternative manufacturer's name or number in a note field, and then trace that in the 028 field also for any alternative numbers and dates. and then you run across probably one of the last albums that ever came out on Stardate was a Charlie Monroe album. On the label it said SLP 472 King. Yeah, King. On the label, I mean on the cover it said SLP 472 Starday. And if you look in the wax, you start peeking through the wax. Now that was naughty of me to look at the wax. And it said 372. You know, that was one time when I said I didn't look at the wax. I mean, yeah.
The one you're talking about, Starday King.
Oh, yeah, yeah, but I'm looking at the master number that pressed that piece of plastic. That's what I was looking at that time.
Which is the more important to you, the date of the release or the date of the actual recording?
Okay, well, both, and again, that's another note which we are trying to add. We are adding that, but added dimension to our note field, is that we note in the field, of course, in the basic body of the cataloging, the date of release. And then there is a field underneath the performer field for date of recording as best we can ascertain. And many times a jazz recording will have no dates. We'll go to Jepson or Brunix and a Rust if we have to many times to get a date. And like with rhythm and blues recordings, the excellent book put out by Ferdy Gonzalez called Discophile. Is Ferdy here today? He's not. He was here yesterday, but his book is a discography of rhythm and blues group recordings, and his book is used for a lot of the collections that we've come up with where we're trying to get a date. It's a lot nicer to know that the recordings by the Five Royales was recorded from 54 to 56 rather than a retake in 1967. We're trying to iron all of that out in our notes.
Handle something like the aliases of Mr. Matagüera.
Pardon me?
The aliases of Mr. Matagüera that you heard about.
Yeah. Okay, well, we have in our authority file, you list the name that the person performs by. Then you can have cross references. I mean, we try to get as many as we can, as many pseudonyms as we can, but we're still having problems with the way even Library of Congress handles the order in which a name appears. The difference between Muddy Waters, Minnie Pearl, and Little Walter. They're all different. Muddy Waters is direct order. Minnie Pearl is direct order. Little Walter is not. It's Walter, comma, Little. You know, so we have a lot of problems with that. But you take the name as you find it on the cover and establish that as an authority or an authority for a group of recordings for that artist that recorded under that name. But remember, this is only popular recordings. We're not dealing with any classical artists whatsoever or composers. Yes?
Are you making entries at all for songwriters or just for the title?
Just for the title.
And do you have any authority
involved
for the title?
No. No, it's beyond our scope. We like to. I mean, I try to correct titles that really look weird, but I mean, we try not. We aren't taking Stardust and saying all Stardust is a two-word title rather than a one-word title. I found a couple. One was a selections from My Fair Lady, where almost every song was the title was not exactly correct, so we went and corrected those. But we found the approach is title. More than anything else, the approach to our collection is by title. We're doing that where we can, right? There aren't that many that I really change a lot.
Yeah, right.
I know that. But we're trying, I mean, see, our cross-reference, any cross-reference that we make goes into our file. It can't go into the OCLC database, am I correct? I don't think you can within that, but we are including that in our own files.
Is a title and an entry synonymous on an OCLC database without any composer at all?
Yes. Yeah, well, you type the first three letters of the first word, two, and then one.
Just the name.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.